The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
I'm Archer Mayer, and that's your cue.
Oh. who am I? Anyway, no, I'm Lynn Abraham. Nice to see you all. Thank you for coming.
There you go. See? We got this routine that we memorized and then forgot. We're getting on. What can I tell you?
No, I didn't forget. I'm just deferring to our esteemed author, since he is a visitor to our city. And I always think that Philadelphians love to welcome visitors and friends, so I'm going to let our esteemed author and officer tell you about himself, and then I'll fill in whatever is
Sounds
left
like
about
a plan.
Me.
Thank you very much, Lynn. So I don't know how any of you may know me or not. Is this too close or too far? How are we doing here?
Perfect.
Don't move the mic. Okay. I come from Vermont, so I got the longest traveled prize afterwards, whatever that may be. In fact, I can tell you what that is. Next door, right next door, we actually supplied the event with tasty cakes and fragments of pretzels, including all the goo that you put on it, because references made in my latest book, Proof Positive, little shill here, the detective that I write about comes down to Philadelphia and eats quizzically, and so we brought samples of that for your enjoyment, no charge, but no stomach pumps either. I did all the research myself and survived the experience. I met Scrapple, which is now a close contender of my other favorite food group, which of course is Spam with Velveeta on white bread with
mayo.
Yeah, exactly right. Thank you. Great minds.
How did I know that? How did I know that? It's like eating corned beef with mayo. Ooh, corned beef and mayo.
I'm a boy of the woods. What can I say? We call our locals up north woodchucks. I don't know what you call yours down here. We should probably go down that line. Lynn was right. I write these during the day and during the time I have left over, because all Vermonters by statute have to have three sources of income. It all comes to a basic living, but that's kind of the rule. And my two other sources of income is I'm a death investigator for the medical examiner's office, and I'm an investigator, sort of variably for the state's attorney's office, which is the district attorney up there in Vermont, or for the state. And my focus until just recently was I was leading up the county, I guess if you looked at TV, the SVU unit, Special Victims. We call it by some other initialization. Lynn and I were joking, in fact, about how many initializations can cops have in a room? Too many to count. So those are my three jobs. The writing is the mothership. That's what I do full-time all the time, 7 days a week. And the rest I just sort of jam in as well I can. And no, I don't sleep much. So obviously each back scratches the other. I started this series of books. This is number 25. I started them in about 1988. They are technically called police procedurals. You can call them cop stories and get away with it. They follow a guy named Joe Gunther, who's the lead investigator, and he has his merry group of men and women who follow along behind him, and they operate out of Vermont. And there's usually a homicide, but not always. Sometimes I deal with other crimes. And I've been doing one a year ever since I started out. It was partway through writing this series of books that I was approached by both the medical examiner's office at one point and a couple of years later by law enforcement to join them. And the reason being that I try to do my research assiduously enough that I would commit a minimum of errors. And I certainly spent a lot of time in the company of these folks be it during investigations or autopsies or whatever it may be. The end result was, as one recruiting sergeant of the Bells Falls Police Department put it, you may know more about policing than we do, so why don't you join us? My only response at the time was, do you know how old I am? But they were way on board with that. And now I'm associated with the Sheriff's Department, and the last deputy we put in the grave was 85 years old, so I think I'm pretty good for employment. We don't retire guys prematurely, so I'll be sort of sitting there and probably in the courthouse, security, quote unquote. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Thanks, Arch. Well, this is very funny because this yellow flyer, which I received announcing this discussion, is very funny because it has Archer Mayer. And it says, one mystery writer and one former district attorney take on crime, fact, and fiction. And it says Archer Mayer. That's not my name, but I'll tell you something very interesting about it. I work for the law firm of Archer and Greiner, so there's Archer.
Oh,
and I'm running for mayor of Philadelphia, so. And frankly, Arch, I can tell you that youth is great, but we have a young president who just got his head and every other part of his anatomy handed to him yesterday. So there's something to be said for experience and tenacity and courage, and that's where I'd come in. So let me tell you a little bit about myself. I was sort of a ragamuffin kid, and I guess everybody in my neighborhood thought that I had a number across my chest before I knew how to spell my name. But I somehow went straight, and like a lot of people of immigrant backgrounds, my family stressed education, education, education. So that's what I did. I went to school. I had a great dream that I was going to become the world's great surgeon. I had great hands and great eyes, and I was going to be something else. However, through a series of circumstances, which I needn't go into here, it just didn't work out that way. So I went to law school because somebody very close to me said, well, you have a big mouth, why don't you go to law school? Seemed to be true on several counts, and so I worked my way through Temple University and Temple Law School. And one of my classmates, although we weren't great friends, was Bill Cosby, and he was fond of saying, I could have gone anywhere, but I chose Temple. And my mantra was just the opposite. I couldn't have gone anywhere, and Temple chose me. So it was either, my father said, you can go any place you want that you can get to on a token, and where you can work your way through and pay your tuition. So I went to work, I went to school every day on a token, went back into town every night, went to work at an office in the afternoon. Then I went to the library at Rittenhouse Square until 9 o'clock. The nice Philadelphia City Library, still is there. And then I would trudge home, study, do some more work, and then the next day go to school. And the next thing was all over again every other day. It was sort of a... if it's Tuesday, it must be studying for exams. But somehow along the line, I got entranced with the prosecutor's office. And the funny thing is, I applied to be an assistant prosecutor, but I was asked a fateful question by the then district attorney of Philadelphia, now deceased, named Jim Crumlish. And they wanted to know what ward I lived in and who was my ward leader. I hadn't a clue what ward I was living in, and I certainly didn't know my ward leader, so that was it. That was the end of my career. So I decided that I would try to get a job, but women weren't getting jobs back then. So I went to work for the federal government, where that was the only place that would hire women who were attorneys, but I hated it. I didn't hate my government. I loved my government. Well, most of the time, anyway. But I hated the job. I just felt I wasn't... that this isn't really what I put all this heart and soul into. So I decided to go to Temple at night and get a master's degree. And one of the courses I took, and this was totally off the wall, was a course taught by the then first assistant district attorney of Philadelphia, Richard Sprague, and a wonderful defense attorney named Martin Vinokur. Marty and Dick were great friends, but they were great adversaries as well. And I took the class, and the third week in, Mr. Sprague called me. You never called him Dick. Mr. Sprague called me to the front of the class and said, why aren't you working in the district attorney's office? I said, well, Mr. Sprague, I didn't know who my ward leader was. He said, you didn't know who your ward leader was? I said, yes. I said, first question is, who's your ward leader? Second question, well, what ward do you live in? I said, I couldn't answer either question, so I didn't get the job. He said, oh, that's ridiculous. Arlen Specter had just been elected district attorney, and he was a hot shot, you know, young DA, and I went to work at the DA's office thanks to Dick Sprague. I owe everything in that regard to Dick Sprague. But having gone there, I excelled because I just loved it. I just poured my whole heart and soul into it. And because I loved it so much, I was looked at as an oddity. Now, I've always been an oddity. And everything I've done has been uncharacteristic, unplanned, unscripted. It's serendipitous totally. So one day, one of the very well-seasoned attorneys named Ivan Michelson Zopp, true story, his whole family was involved in the Eastern Orthodox Church. And Ivan was the son of a patriarch of the church. But Ivan was also a prosecutor and a very good one. Looked something right out of Rasputin's tales. Had long, droopy mustache and sort of long hair. Terrifically bright, very lovely, but he became ill. And I got a letter, a little note from Sprague that said, see me. And that was like a letter of doom. You knew if you went into Dick Sprague's office, off with your head and anything else he wanted to take off. So I walked in there, and he said, I looked up over his eyeglasses, sort of like this. He said, what are you doing tomorrow? I said, I'm in 483. He said, no, you're not. He said, you're trying this case. I said, I'd made a fateful mistake. I said, but Dick. He said, I don't ever want to hear but Dick out of you. And I knew as soon as I looked at the file, it was a homicide file. And what I did then was from that minute, I left the office, went out to the scene, looked at the scene of this killing, which was at an area in North Philly at Park Avenue and Boston Street, which is above Temple University. A youngish man had been murdered with, we don't know what, but his entire face was just chopped up. His jugular was cut. He bled to death on the street. And nobody knew anything. So there's no evidence in this case. So I became my own death investigator. And then took the time it was to draw the jury to do my investigations. And it's funny, you say when I read your book, which I did, I said, well, they'd never do this in Vermont. I mean, in Vermont, they go up to houses all by themselves. They walk into places they don't know all alone. Never happened in Philadelphia. You need backup. You need flashlights. You need lights and sirens, which is what we call it, lights and sirens. Lots of troops. You never go into a house by yourself. I said, well, these guys are crazy. They walk into a house all by themselves. They don't know who's there. 12 guys, Tommy guns, booby traps. Anyway, so I found a barber shop on the corner, and there was a wonderful African-American barber there. And now, this was a neighborhood that was African-American, and I am not African-American, and I didn't need a haircut. So the guy looks at me, clipping hair, and he asked me what I wanted, and I said, well, I'd rather wait till you can talk. And he finished his haircut. And I sat down with him, and I said, I'm an assistant district attorney. I was like 12, you know. Well, he wasn't giving me anything. I said, listen. I said, I know you know because you're right across the street. You couldn't have missed it. Turns out that he was the father. This is really weird. He was the father of a singer named Tammy Terrell, who was the singing partner of Marvin Gaye, right? But he also was a bookmaker, which every barber in North Philly was. So I started to talk to him bookmaking stuff. And he said, well, how do you know so much about bookmaking? I said, my father's a bookmaker. It's true. It's true. So he said, okay, I'll tell you. And he told me exactly what happened, that he was an eyewitness to the murder, that he saw this young guy accost this other youngish man who was sort of drunk, try to rob him. And when the man resisted, he took a bottle, broke it over something, and cut the man's throat and face and murdered him. And the guy had nothing. He was an old drunk, a young drunk. He had nothing on him. And then he had to be my witness, which was really a tough sell. But he came through, and I found some other evidence at the medical examiner's office, and I wound up hanging out at the medical examiner's office because, after all, I was going to be the great surgeon.
Indeed you were.
And you can't make mistakes when a person is deceased, but it was utterly fascinating. I have to tell you that we do not have a keen appreciation for how marvelous our bodies are. Mm-hmm. This extraordinary piece of equipment, this brain that everybody has, is so fabulous, can process information faster and better than any electronic device. We have muscles and sinews and bones. And I mean, to this day, I must have attended 5,000 autopsies if I've attended one. And they absolutely carry me off because I look at this temple as just that, a temple. I mean, we're not worth very much in terms of what we're, you know, if we were cremated, we'd be in a little bag, about 6 pounds.
Yep.
And sort of gray ash. But, there's a Shakespearean sonnet, "What a Piece of Work is Man." And that sonnet tells all about how noble we are and what this great temple of our learning we have. But on the street, there isn't much regard for it. And I was asking our friend, the author, I said, "Listen, Anna, how many homicides do you have up in Vermont?" And he said, "Oh, in a busy year, maybe 7. I said, "That's a good weekend in Philadelphia." 7, we probably have 7 by Saturday. And in a bad weekend, we've had, unfortunately, many, many more. Oh, yeah. Lots of shootings and lots of killings. So I became fascinated with trying cases. I love working with people, so I had no trouble dealing with jurors of all shapes, kinds, sizes, and descriptions. And I trusted the people that if you gave them the evidence that proved what we were supposed to prove, guilt of the crime and every one of the elements of the crime beyond a reasonable doubt, they would, 99 times out of 100, do the right thing and bring back the right verdict, whatever that was, whether it was guilty, or if I failed in my proof, it would be not guilty. And I told all of my assistants, and I tell you, ladies and gentlemen, that when you get a jury duty notice, and I've gotten them, and I go, I didn't do that while I was a judge for 16 years, obviously, or the district attorney, but I have been on jury duty 3 times in the past 3 years, and I would never fail to show up. I'm never selected, but I go because it's my duty. Well, who's going to ask the prosecutor?
Yeah, right.
Come on, and a judge.
You and me both.
That's right. They wouldn't ask. Well, actually, I'll tell you something interesting. The head of the Public Defenders Association, who is now a judge on our court, was selected by one of my assistants for jury duty. Guess what? He convicted the guy because we proved to the public defender, chief public defender, that the guy was guilty, and he did his duty, and that's what you're supposed to do. So I do encourage you, when you get your jury duty notice, please show up. You may be fortunate enough to sit on a jury, and you have no idea how well this government works when you're in charge of it. I mean, we're always thinking about let somebody else do it, but you have all the power. You, ladies and gentlemen, have the power to decide, did the tremendous power of the state, and I never thought of myself as powerful, but I knew I had it. I mean, as a judge and as a district attorney, you know, if you have to tell people how powerful you are, you don't have it.
Well, you lost it.
Yeah. You never had it, or you don't appreciate it, or you've lost it. So, but there is a power of the state, because the state, through its police department, has the right to take us into custody, deprive us of our freedom, you know, put us in a jail, take us before a court. We can do a ton of time, or our life or death. And then who makes the decision of whether or not I am proven guilty or not guilty? You. You, all of you. You're the ones who make the decision. The prosecutor is only there as a vehicle for presenting the evidence to you, and the defense attorney on the other side is there to represent the interest of the defendant to make sure the accused gets his or her full day in court and gets the best possible defense. And I'll tell you something interesting. In my lifetime, I've seen people who were defendants 1 week, and 2 weeks later, they were victims. Mm. Sometimes they were shot and survived. The next time they shot somebody who may or may not have shot them and killed them. So you're a victim 1 week or a defendant the next, but you're still entitled to the same rights of trial by jury. And that's where you, ladies and gentlemen, come in. So I need you to know that you have real power. You exercised it yesterday in the voting booth. but only 50% of you came out. I was one of your 50%. But whatever happens in the polling booth is up to us, and whatever happens in the jury room is also up to us. And I think we need the power of the people to keep people in power in check. It prevents our government from going overboard and depriving us, you and me and everybody else, of our liberty without due process of law. So that's sort of my 15 minutes of who I am and where I come from, and we can take it from there. There's a whole bunch of other things that we're supposed to talk about urban versus rural and contrast between a Vermont police office and...
We've touched a little bit on that already. Mm-hmm. The odd part, of course, is just in the numbers, not only of homicides and statistics and whatnot, but just people. How many people live in the city of Philadelphia?
Roughly 1,400,000+.
Okay, and all
there's always
of Vermont,
a dispute about
border
exactly
to
how
border,
many.
Are 600,000.
Right.
How many certified police officers are there in the city?
Around, give or take, 6,000.
1,000. So it's a whole different approach now. Of course, we don't mow them down in huge numbers in the streets, but. The other interesting thing, to your point earlier, is that the psychology applied at the street level before it goes into the judicial process remains fascinating to me, because in contrast to the young man with whom I had to go on shift one day, I worked on patrol in a village called Bellows Falls, which is 1 square mile, another contrast and reflective of my environment. But its nickname with the statistician up in the Montpelier, which we nickname Mount Peculiar, which is the state capital, he calls it Dodge City because, again, of the statistics. It's got the worst high school. It's got the worst welfare problems. It's got the worst crime statistics. It's just whatever you want to go along the bottom, you'll find Bellows Falls all the time. So that's the department that hired me. And I was delighted to work there, but reflective again of the paucity of numbers, if you came in at the ground floor, you're given your gun, your keys, access to a shared cruiser, and you were told if you catch a case, you work the case all the way up to the top.
That never happens here.
Of course not.
Never happens.
It's all very specialized, but there, you're stuck with it. So you learn by the seat of your pants, and you need to use your noggin. So, yes, they give you a stick and a pepper spray and guns and cuffs and heavy boots to kick people with and whatnot, but do you utilize any of those if you have any brains at all? The answer is obviously no.
Right.
You know, you use your mind, you use your mouth, you go in there, you seduce people with your personality, and I got more people responding with a thank you when I put handcuffs on them than putting up a fuss, which is pretty unusual. But that's the way it worked. And the way I also saw myself as part of a complicated, integrated process, not at the beginning and the end. And I, unlike some of my colleagues, never got angry at, oh, well, goddamn Vermont, because as you may know, Vermont is actually a socialist state. There are 49 states in the Union and Vermont. You know? And the reason is we only have Democrats, and the only Republicans who show up have to be moderate Republicans or they're shown the door. And it's almost that bad or that lopsided. It's an extraordinarily weird state.
It's very beautiful. Vermont is probably one of the most gorgeous places.
Oh, it is a stunner,
yep,
which is why I swore when I started writing these books 25 years ago I would never write about fat, happy, syrup-sipping cows standing under beautiful trees. Leave that to the Chamber of Commerce.
Well, I'll tell you, Philadelphia Police Department has had its troubles over the years. We have had, and somehow along the way, and I could never understand why, our police officers feel sometimes, and I don't speak for police officers, I just speak for me, but the sense I get is that a lot of officers feel beleaguered that they think that they're out there trying to protect the public, but some of the public doesn't think very highly of them. Mm-hmm. And there's this tension, palpable. Sometimes it's racial tension, sometimes it's ethnic tension, sometimes it's just tension of a quality you can't figure out why. And when you have that kind of interaction, which is based on tension and fear, mm-hmm. and it's fearful, it's fear, yeah. There's a tendency sometimes to overreact. And we do not, in Philadelphia, have very many people who are afraid to pull out a gun on a cop. It's not uncommon for anybody to pull out a gun on anybody in Philadelphia. I'm not saying it's everybody, and I'm not. This is a great city. I live in the city. I have lived in the city all my life and will live in the city until they carry me right from my house to wherever they're going to deposit me at the end of my time. But there's not a compunction by anybody to pull a gun on police. And by the way, we have had, not recently, thankfully, but while I was district attorney for 19 years, we had many, many police officers killed. I went to a lot of funerals. Yeah. I went to a lot of funerals of dead people too, shot mm-hmm. by other people. Sometimes I was asked by the family of the deceased, you know, some kid who got mm-hmm. killed by some other young kid, and there wasn't a dime's worth of difference between the two kids. Just one yeah. survived and one didn't, and spoke at a lot of funerals. But the hesitancy factor in pulling a firearm on somebody is non-existent in Philadelphia.
Where, by contrast, in Vermont, which is the only state in the union with no gun laws whatsoever, we're it. The NRA loves us.
Sure.
Except we don't like them because we carry guns to go hunting.
Yes. Well, see, your difference between you and us is that yeah. you're carrying long guns. We're carrying, in Philadelphia, semi-automatic pistols and some with banana clips. That so yeah. You can kill, you know, half a room full of people, and the level of distrust, anger, fear, resentment also means that when a police officer, see in Vermont, there aren't any alleys to speak of.
Right.
So in Philadelphia, when a police officer says to somebody, for example, "Hey, you," or something like that, "Yo, I want to talk to you," and the person takes off down the alley, the officer has two choices. I think I'll let it go. But most times, not all the time, but most times, they jump out of their squad car and they run down a dark alley and they frequently draw their service pistol.
Yeah.
Used to be a revolver, almost nobody. I can't think of one person who carries a revolver anymore. Pulls out his pistol and the cop is hollering, "Stop, stop," and the person turns around. Now that's a near fatal mistake. When they say stop, they want you to just stop.
Yeah.
Just stop with your back to them. But the minute somebody turns around, then the police officer has to make a decision. Shoot, don't shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be sometimes a fatal and very complicated error, good or bad. And yeah. sometimes the person has, where's my cell phone? Somebody.
Sure.
So, for example, no, wrong pocket. I got so many pockets and
cell phone. It'll take you a long time to get shot.
Well, yes, it would. I said, "Just a minute, I'm pulling out my cell phone. Hold it there, officer, 1 minute, please." I think, wherever the heck it is. So I pull out my cell phone, and I'm turning around, and the police officer thinks gun because
sure.
it's dark.
Yep.
And I have this thing in my hand, and I turn around, yep. and boom, I'm shot. And if I'm lucky, I'm not killed, but sometimes I'm not lucky. Then there are all the other issues of class, race, gender, all this other stuff comes boiling yeah. over.
Yeah.
And that can make for a really bad time.
All
a
of
really
which is missing
time.
In Vermont, you know, which is the beauty. We have officer deaths. They get run over. They drown during a body recovery operation. They rarely, for all the guns, and in fact there are more handguns than you could imagine in Vermont as well, but and fully automatic stuff, you know, at least according to my neighbor who mm-hmm. unloads around midnight just because he likes the flicker. Thank God he hasn't aimed at my house
yet. I think he does live in
yet.
A weird place, doesn't he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No.
I'm
don't
sorry.
Call him woodchucks
sounds nice,
for nothing.
But. Sounds nice, but.
There are a lot of seriously, or as we say, wicked, crazy people there.
Yep.
But we, cops don't generally get pulled on, very rarely get beaten up, or certainly don't get shot by their fellow Vermonters almost ever. But by contrast, here's a lovely story coming out of Brattleboro. A young woman graduates from the 18 weeks at the academy. There's only one academy in the entire state that educates us all. And she comes to Brattleboro, and she's, you know, all, everything shiny and buffed, and she still has the original creases in her uniform, and she's going on her first hour of her first full-fledged solo duty, and she's in the parking lot of the police department, and she's confronted with a man with a gun. A man with a knife. And the knives are often, there's the 21-foot rule. I don't know if any of you heard that, but if you are within 25 feet, an officer with his or her gun and the guy with a knife, statistics or studies of this have established again and again and again that the guy with a knife will most often win if he's within 21 feet. So this guy's very close to her. He's got a knife. He's whacked out. He just came out of the institution that's Brattleboro is famous for, called the Retreat. And it's a suicide by cop situation. He wants to die, so he comes at her. She pulls out her brand new gun. She fires and shoots the knife right out of his hand. Okay. Then he's brought down with tasers. He's buttoned up, and everything ends very well. Brattleboro, which is sort of the queen bee of this socialist state I just alluded to, okay, they couldn't be more delighted. They halloo her. They say that she is just, you know, straight-eyed, tricksy, just unbelievable, Annie Oakley incarnate. They were just beside themselves with praise for this young woman. All of us sent her back to the range to learn how to fire a gun.
That's right. If you're going to pull a gun, you shoot to kill.
Yeah.
That's what cops are taught.
So everyone said, she's great. We all said, she missed.
Well, I can tell you that that we do have. The interesting thing is we do have an inordinate number of people in major cities across the United States who are mentally ill. Yeah. They're alcohol addicted, drug addicted, and seriously mentally ill. And we wanted to be a kinder, gentler nation so we don't commit these people to mental facilities. As a matter of fact, it gets harder and harder to commit people unless they are proven to be a danger to themselves or others. Yeah. And it is not uncommon for a mentally ill person who is just so incapable of appreciating what's going on to try to provoke a cop into killing them. And for those of you who don't know that statement, suicide by cop, there are people who sometimes, not all the time, but sometimes really want to be killed. They provoke an officer. They tell the cop, shoot me, shoot me, shoot me. And the cop says, I don't want to shoot this guy. I don't even know him. Why should I kill him? And they try to reason with them. They go, no, kill me, kill me. And sometimes they really do get very, very crazy. And I can tell you, I have had cases where a person was very, very tiny, but totally whacked from drugs or alcohol or mental illness or all of the above. They are so strong. You cannot overcome them. These little tiny, skinny
including
people.
Including with a taser.
Oh, forget it. They have so much adrenaline going that you can't bring them down. But we do have that. We have a huge homeless population in the city of Philadelphia. And many of them, by the way, who use this library as sort of a second home. I was worried, should I go in the bathroom before I came in here or shouldn't I? Some lady was washing up. I mean, she had her whole parnosa there, her whole suitcase, undressing and dressing in the bathroom and washing herself in the sink. And she left the water on, and I said, hey, you want to conserve water? But and I said, never mind. So I turned off the water. But it's a little dicey here. But we do have a significant homeless population in Philadelphia. But fortunately, we have Sister Mary Scullion, if you're going to write about somebody, you ought to write about Sister Mary Scullion. Now, Sister Mary, you look at her and you go, oh, you know, some nun, some quiet, you know, mousy little sister of St. Joseph or whatever order she belongs to, some nice lady. Oh, please, she's like dealing with a house on fire. She has gotten more social programs for homeless people. She has an outreach program to Beat the Band, and she does homeless populations, outreach. I get phone calls from tons of homeless people. They just want to talk to me, 20, 30 minutes. I can't listen. You know, I'm in private practice. I have to account for my time, you know. If I were DA, they could talk to me forever. They grab me on the street. In fact, it's really funny. I came through the library, and a gentleman sitting outside, he has this pile. His whole life is on the table. And you can see the man has issues. But he recognized me. He said, "Hey, Miss Abraham. He stood up, put out his hand. I said, "Hey, what are you doing?" I said, "I see you got a lot of work out here." He said, "Yeah." He says, I'm learning the law." He pulls out a John Grisham book. It's called Street Law. God's Truth. Very nice man. Not harming a person. Very gentle, very quiet. But he was like studying. He says, "I'm never going to be as good as you, but I'm studying the law." I said, "Listen, John Grisham is a great writer." I said, "You read every word of his writings, and you will be a great thinker." And what am I going to tell the guy? Go to law school? I mean, he's a wonderful guy. He's just needing somebody to get. I'll tell you what that man needed. I think he needed what I gave him, a pat on the back and say, "You go ahead and read that book, and John Grisham is a great writer, and you'll learn a good deal of the law." And he had showed me some other papers he had there, and he was just trying to get it together, and I was saluting him. It's all good. Most of the people are really okay. Some of them are a little frightening, but most of them are really okay, just looking for a nice warm place and someone to leave them alone or even say a nice word to them. And so Sister Mary takes care of all these people. She's fabulous. Just fabulous. So I wanted to talk one thing about rural versus Philadelphia, because I think one of the things that's happened in medical examining and homicide investigation, or really anything investigation, is we have been dramatically impacted by television, whether we like it or not. That I always remarked to my assistants, gee, if we only could climb around on the rug and pull out the hair that everybody's looking for. Oh, here it is. Because everybody on a jury expects that. If you don't have a fingerprint, a blood spatter,
or epithelials, which they don't even know what it means, epithelia, but they ask for it.
Epithelias, if you do like this on your hand, some flakes of your skin, or if you scratch your head like that, some flakes of our skin, our epithelium, will fall on the ground. Now, go find them, but that's another story. I mean, you can vacuum all you want. You'll find everybody's scales of skin in this room, plus everybody who was here if they didn't sweep up. Or they want a fingerprint, they want a DNA sample, they want a urine sample, they want a semen sample. They want some scientific evidence. And in most of the cases, there aren't scientific evidences available. Many times there are, because the person, for example, goes in the refrigerator and wants a drink, goes to the bottle in your fridge while you're not here and says, "Oh, good gin. That is good gin." Put it back down, get busy, you know, trying to scoop up whatever they can scoop up and leave the bottle on the table. Well, that has two things on it. It has the potential for my fingerprints if I'm not wearing gloves. And unless my water drinking washed away my DNA that I may have left on this bottle, it might have my DNA.
Yep.
And that's what people are looking for. The whole scientific field has changed because what we thought was scientific isn't really scientific. For example, we used to think that tire tracks were scientific, but a lot of our courts aren't accepting just tire tracks anymore because the mold isn't right. There's a million tires made like this, and just because the defendant has a tire like this doesn't mean that he's the doer. Could have been a handyman who had nothing to do with anything but just happened to be in your property. We've had a lot of homicides where the DNA, I'll give you one example. We had a murder in Philadelphia of a young woman. We called her the Center City Jogger. Her name was Kimberly Ernst. Kimberly Ernst was found murdered in a stairwell on a Center City street, like Lombard Street as I recall. And she was wearing one of those running suits, a very skin-tight running suit, which was partially removed. There were two guys who were arrested, and I'm almost reluctant to mention their names, but I'll just call them one and two because I don't want to give them any publicity. They're such bad people. So anyway, they tried to rape her, and they couldn't. They couldn't for a couple of reasons. Number one, they couldn't get and maintain an erection, because she was fighting them, and they were in a stairwell, she was screaming bloody murder. They were trying to get off her tracksuit, which was difficult enough. And so they never consummated any sexual assault, but they murdered her. She was found dead when sunlight came. So, of course, they took her body to the medical examiner's office, and they found in her vagina seminal fluids, the remnants of sexual activity. And they did a DNA test and said, okay, here's the genome of the person who had sex with this woman, and it must be one of our two doers. Well, when we compared their DNA to the DNA in this dead woman, it didn't match. It was not a match. And we told the defense attorney, hey, it wasn't either one of your guys. And, of course, to great fanfare, they said, hey, somebody raped her, but it wasn't our guys, and our guys didn't kill her, and she was acquitted. The guys were acquitted. Mm-hmm. They were subsequently convicted of something almost equally heinous, but they beat this case. And here's the problem about DNA. Just because you find it in somebody or on somebody or in somebody's house doesn't mean that they are a killer. Turns out that this young woman was having an affair with a married person someplace. I'm not going to say where or who or why. And they had unprotected sex, as lovers frequently do. He was married, she wasn't. And the next day when she went out jogging, she still had his seminal fluid inside of her. And when they did the DNA testing on her, it was this guy's. Now, can you imagine? Now, just think about this for a minute, folks. You're on a jury, and you're waiting for somebody to come up and own up to the DNA. Now, do you think for a moment that a married man would come up and say, guess what? I was having an affair with her last night, but I didn't kill her. Oh, yeah, that'll go over. And you know what? The chances are that maybe some police officer, detective, investigator would say, wait a minute. I know. They were having an affair. She promised to go to his wife unless he left his wife and married her, so he murdered her. Oh, no, this can get too weird.
Sounds like one of my books.
Well, it does happen. So we lost that case, and my guess is we should have lost the case because the right DNA wasn't there.
Yeah.
But it's almost an expectation by our juries now that we have DNA. And the difficulties with rural versus city is that when a big case happens, sometimes a rural area can handle it better than us, and sometimes they can't because it's so big and so hot that everybody's running all over the crime scene and doing things. What happens is when you have big stories like Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman, now you'd think Los Angeles, they really know how to do homicide cases. They get lots of them. They screwed up this case royally from the get-go, whereas a guy maybe in rural Vermont wouldn't walk all over the scene track boots and leave stuff in the trunk of the car, you know, and have a judge who cries on the witness. Oh. And two or three incompetent prosecutors. I just said, I'm going to tear my hair up, but I don't like looking bald, so I won't do it. But maybe Vermont would handle it better. Sometimes it's the opposite.
They would nowadays, yeah. We actually have a state-of-the-art forensics lab. But nevertheless, it's all about the money. You have to watch those costs, and you can't do what they do on CSI on TV, which, as we all know, is complete and utter make-believe.
Yep.
But here's another little wrinkle, then we will go to questions. That got me cranked up here. There's a flip side to that, and that is that the science, because I spent some time down at Brookhaven National Lab picking their brains about how they do stuff, now the DNA is available in such minute but analyzable quantities.
Mitochondrial DNA.
That you, in effect, it's everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as you want to spend the time and have the money or the ability to collect it, you can find, DNA all over this room on top of one another. If you just so much as sneeze on each other, you're covering your DNA with someone
else. But it doesn't make you a killer.
Doesn't necessarily make you a killer, but more and more cases are getting into trouble because of this. Okay, we should entertain questions, so just raise your hand and bellow.
Oh, the question is how I closed in on Ira Einhorn. For those of you, I'll give you a croaky, just a croaky of Ira Einhorn. Ira Einhorn was a man who fashioned himself to be a guru. And he was really a poseur and a bum. But he convinced everybody he was very smart. And along the way, he picked up a lot of women, but only if they were wealthy. He didn't deal in poor women. And he found himself in a relationship with a woman named Holly Maddox, who came from a well-to-do family in Texas. She was going to school in Philadelphia. And something happened between them, and he wound up taking some kind of a rock. We think it was a rock, and smashing in her head. He put her in a trunk in his apartment and locked the closet and the trunk in it, stuffed her with papers, and went jaunting around the world. And two medical students below smelled this horrible smell, and being medical students, they said, this smells like a dead body. And then he said, no, he said there was a squirrel that got caught in my flu and he rotted, and that's what you're smelling. So everything sort of bumped along until the Maddoxes tried to get an FBI agent to find out where Holly was. And many, many, many months later, they found Holly's mummified remains in the trunk. And Arlen Specter had been the DA, but then he left office because he wanted to run for something else, and he was defeated by Emma Fitzpatrick, and he wanted to run for mayor and governor, and he never was elected to either one of those. But when he left office, he then became a defense attorney in 5 minutes, and I was very disappointed in that. I mean, I don't mind that prosecutors become defense attorneys. It happens all the time. But the district attorney? Sorry, it didn't compute well with me. But okay, that was his choice. He represented Ira Einhorn and went in front of a judge and got him released on bail. Now, in a murder case, this where proof is evident and the presumption is great that this is a first-degree murder case, which this was, he never should have been permitted to go out on bail. And Arlen promised the judge, I guarantee he will come to court when I tell him to come to court. Well, guess what? He disappeared. 25 years later.
Oh, my God.
He was all over Europe, and what I did was, I'm like the Mounties. I always get my man. I was all over him like a cheap suit. We finally found him through a quirk of circumstances. He was all over Europe, and every time Interpol got within 12 feet of him, somebody tipped him off, and he escaped. We finally found out through his girlfriend, who was very rich, again, a Swedish girl, who took up with him. I don't know why. He smelled bad. He looked bad. He was a beast. But okay. You can't legislate love, so okay. I'm for that. Anyway, she bought him a house in Champagne-Mouton, France. Beautiful little village in the Champagne region. And she went to apply for a driver's license. And we knew her name. So when it came up on Interpol, we knew where they were living. And we got the Interpol and the police, our guys, we grabbed him, it put him in custody, and that's when the trouble really began, because he got himself a fancy Dan French lawyer who said, oh, if you bring the client back, France, which used to cut off everybody's head at the Place de la Concorde, everybody been to France and see where they used to do the guillotine number? Oh, they're absolutely opposed, you know, France who gave up to the Nazis, you know. With the largest standing army in Europe. So they said, oh, no, you can't take him back. He'll be subject to the death penalty. So I had to get a special act of our legislature passed, which thankfully I did, that this man would not be subject to the death penalty, because when he committed this murder, and this is the truth, there was no death penalty in Pennsylvania. So I hadn't to give up anything because he wouldn't be eligible for the death penalty anyway. So I didn't give up anything, but I was willing, even if it was, to give it up to get him back here. Well, then they said, oh, no, you can't do that, blah, blah, blah. So I went to Felix Roetten, the then United States ambassador to France, and wrote him and petitioned him. Then I spoke to Janet Reno, the attorney general, who was a personal friend of mine on two separate occasions. I spoke to Madeleine Albright. And finally, I had the occasion when President Clinton came to Philadelphia. I met him at the airplane down at the private little strip where presidents come in. And there I was standing in line waiting to greet him. And I said, Mr. President, you have to get Ira Einhorn back for me from France. I said, I've spoken to Felix Roetten, Janet Reno, Madeleine Albright. It's all in a document. I mean, I'll send everything to you. He said, okay. He said, oh, my God, who's this nutcase woman I'm talking to? Anyway, the bottom line is we waited almost 5 years through the court system of France. Finally, sending our lawyers over and the Maddox family to France 4 and 5 times, we finally took the case to the highest French court and the equivalent of our Supreme Court, and got him back to the United States, tried him and convicted him. And that's the second time, because we tried him in absentia the first time, but France doesn't recognize that, so we had to guarantee him a new trial. I did that. And that's 25 years of it's persistence and determination. If you want to solve a problem, you have to be persistent and determined. And I was persistent and determined. He's not the only one I brought back from overseas. He's just one of our... I got one guy back from Korea, one guy back from England. I'm an international terror. I'm bad for diplomatic relations, but the Mounties have to get their man. Otherwise, these guys just think they can do whatever they want.
I have a question if nobody else does. By the way, I'm a fan. I'm on number 15 now. That's the sniper's wife.
Oh, my gosh.
Your people have left Vermont, and they're lost somewhere in New York. I'm not quite sure.
Not hard to do.
If they're going to get them or not. But I love the books.
And, thank you.
I want to talk about the writing there for a moment, if I may.
Sure.
Many of the best TV series have been series where the ensemble is what pulls it together. You get WKRP, you get one of my favorites is The West Wing, and it's because the characters are all interplaying. And you're doing the same characters, the major ones anyway, book after book after book. Do you see yourself as running that kind of an operation, or do you have something else in mind?
No, I set out to, in effect, introduce a family of characters to my readers. If you take Joe Gunther that I've touched on all by himself, he's possibly the most boring human being you'll ever meet. He's avuncular and thoughtful and supportive and a team player. And, I mean, you know, horrible things happen and he's understanding. Basically, watching grass grow or paint dry is right up there with being in the company of Joe Gunther. So I had to surround him with opposites or complementary characters, and that's his squad, which immediately turns him into sort of the go-to mentor father figure, the one with feet of clay, however, because this is no superhero. I chose the name Joe Gunther because it was the dullest, least interesting name I could think of. It's probably one in every phone book in America. And I wanted this guy to be an everyman who is an extraordinary man, but only because of his normalcy. But the whack jobs who surround him, who are all very energized, and some of them very much like cops with whom I've worked. In fact, no one ever comes to me and says, oh, you know, I worked with Joe Gunther. They never say that. They always say, oh, I worked with Willie Kunkel, who is my single most dysfunctional character. But that was sort of what I had in mind from the get-go. I wanted to write a series, and I didn't really want to write a bunch of whodunits. I wanted to write about us, about the human character, about human conflict, about the very things we've been talking about tonight. That's what the series is about. I throw in a dead guy and a car chase and a whodunit aspect because I want to sell books, but basically these are anthropologies. They're all about us.
So you cover a lot of different subjects in your books. You do everything from like World War II to hoarders. It's a two-part question. How do you decide what you're going to write the next book about, and do you ever have any trouble with getting the research done if it's a particularly strange?
The ideas come to me because of the two other jobs, the death investigator and the cop, expose me. I mean, I get uninvited into people's houses all the time. They may not want me there, but either they're too dead to protest or they don't have a choice because I have lots of heavily armed friends who are much bulkier than I. That's another reason I don't get into bar fights is because I'm built this way. But I get to see stuff. And so you referenced hoarding. Well, I've been in a number of hoarding environments, and one of which sticks to mind where we opened the door, laid down a ladder, and climbed up 4 to 5 feet to get into the house. And from room to room to room to room, we all had to slither under the doorways rather than walk through. And you can imagine why we were called there. So the over-differousness was thick in the air, and we had to find the erstwhile owner. And it got really complicated and so fabulously over the top, I actually couldn't even write about it if I wanted to. Not that I would have, because I never put real cases into my books. I think that's unethical and flat-out rude. But then how do you go beyond that? I've written books about rape, and so people say, oh, so you interviewed a lot of rapists? No. Rapists, by and large, as you pointed out, are pretty brain-dead people. So you talk to the people who have done a lot of talking to rapists, so psychologists or social workers or people who handle vast numbers of the identity population you're researching, those are the guys you want to talk to. So I spend about, 4, 5, 6 months out of each year researching to this extent. My pet line is that I write each book out of ignorance and curiosity. So I just pursue what interests me, and I don't write a plot, and I don't write an outline. I just follow where my intellect needs to be satiated. So I research a lot more than I need, and I probably write more than I need to write, and then I turn out the final product through a massive amount of editing.
That's everything that your creative writing instructor told you not to do, in
yes.
other words.
Yes, exactly
That's
right.
That's what it sounds like. I said, I took creative writing. I'm not a creative writer, but I said, he's doing everything backwards. They told
yep.
us not to do that.
Never do that. Never do that. Yeah, exactly. Do what I say and not
who
as
else
I
has
do.
Who else has a question? Somebody has to have a daring question. Yes. He likes soft pretzels with mustard.
My glutton
where's Patty,
for punishment.
Where's Patty Pat? Where's Patty Pat Kozlowski? Oh, there you go. Patty Pat Kozlowski comes from Port Richmond. She'll tell you about soft pretzels and mustard.
Stock's cake.
Stock's cake, absolutely.
Ah, see, that's the one I missed. I got the pretzels and the mustard, though. I think if you read the book in that section, I cover about 15 different food groups, or at least I tried. If these people don't go home with a stomach ache, then I totally misconstrued the scene. I come down in this book to Philadelphia just as I've been to Chicago or New York or Montreal or Quebec City or whatever, or Sherbrooke, because of the fact that in rare cases, police officers are, in fact, once they say, Mother, may I, and they've gotten the blessing of their superiors, they can occasionally be sent out in pursuit of a case. It happens rarely. Budgetary matters are always a major concern, and Vermont in and of itself is no different. But this is fiction. And each book is a whole new trip around the fishbowl. So I like to travel myself. I like to bring these experiences to bear, and I love the contrast between those places and Vermont. Because it allows me to offset what the Vermonters are going through and what their life experience is versus something like Philadelphia. So it's not the first time that Joe Gunther and his pals come to an urban environment like this and sort of try to control their jaw from hitting the ground because it's such a completely different experience for them than it is back home.
Yeah. When you wrote your very first book, did you see it as 25 books down the line? Well, I mean, when you first started creating this character, did you just see it as a one and done, and then it took legs of its own, or did you really look at it?
I did see it as a series. I actually set out to tell an ongoing story of people in conflict and their evolution as individuals, which is part of the reason I introduced all these people and part of the reason that I was, even from the second book, already involved in developing them. So if you read the books in order, you'll get this sort of sense of background that is missing if you read them out of order, even though they're all written as individual novels. That's just because I'm paranoid about being thrown out of print, but nevertheless. The plan, however, was to write 5 or 6 of these books and then put a down payment on the island next to Johnny Depp's. Because the reviews were really good, and of course, if you do this, you become a millionaire. 25 books later, this is the best I could afford. But I'm a happy camper. I am truly doing what I love to do. So it's no complaints. Yes?
Okay, so actually I have 2 questions, but they're not my questions. I'd like to know, Lynn, what are you burning with curiosity to know from Archer? And Archer, what one question are you burning with curiosity to ask Lynn about?
You can go first.
Okay, well, I'm burning with curiosity with all your background, your experience, your obvious intelligence, your total embracing of life. Mayor's office?
Well, see, mental illness runs in my family.
Mine too.
My late husband, may he rest in peace. I think I'm doing this really waiting till after he passed because years ago, people came to me and says, we want you to run for mayor. So I go home to my husband and I said, Ed, guess what? I said, some people have asked me to run for mayor. Well, you thought he was a rocket that had just been ignited right through the house. And he said, and I won't give you the exact language, but he said something like, are you out of your blankety, blankety, blankety mind? And I said, what? He said, do you like being the captain of the Titanic every single day? You wake up knowing that at the end of the day, that sucker is going to sink with you on it. And all those people going down with you. What's the matter? You're not happy being district attorney? That's not good enough for you? I said, Ed, it's a calling. You know, it's a calling. It's not for glory. It's not for money. It's not for pension. It's not for anything. It's in your blood. It's like a sickness. And I said, remember, my husband was a Jaguar lover. He loved, or as the British call them, Jaguars. He had an XKE, he had a Mark 9, he had a Mark 10, he had a sedan, he had everything. He had an XKE, loved this XKE. And he always used to complain about it because when it rained, it would never start.
Right. British engineering.
British. And he said, it always rains in Britain. How can they make a car that never starts? And of course, as you know about cars, yeah. My father taught me when I was a kid to fix cars, because you could fix them then without a computerized whole system. And whenever I went out on a date and the car didn't start, that was the last I ever saw the guy, but take off the butterfly valve, you know, do that. Anyway, it's something. I said, remember you used to tell me that like being in love with Jaguars is like being in love with a bad woman. You know she won't start. You know she'll run around. You'll know she's no good for you, but you love her anyway. I said, that's the way I feel about public service. But being, I think, a thoughtful person and a good wife, I said, you know what? This is not worth making a big fight with my husband. And besides what, she was 25 years my senior, and I was never home anyway. So, and I said to myself, if I'm the mayor, I'll never, never be home.
Right.
And even though we ate at 10 or 10:30 every night, when we went to Spain, I said, Ed, they're eating like us. What, are they all nuts? So I said, this isn't worth it. But when he became ill and died, and I left the DA's office and went into private practice, in the back of my mind was always this nagging thing going on, saying, stupid, you should have. And I said, no, I shouldn't have. I did the right thing. I thought about family first. But I don't have any children. He has a daughter and grown children and grandchildren. And I have nobody. I live alone. I have a wonderful life. I'm not complaining. This is all good. I've had a great, wonderful 34-year marriage and a wonderful husband. Could not be better. And I said, why not? I know that I'm not 12. I earned every one of these gray hairs, but no one will outwork me. No one will outmaneuver me. No one will outdesire me. And I don't need a salary. I don't need a pension. I don't need anything. This is all about us, you and we together. This is all about us. How can we move this city forward? Because while it looks great, and it is a wonderful city, and I love it, we have a failing school system. We have a pension that's choking us to death. We have almost 30% poverty. We have non-existent workforce development from inside the city, from that one-third. We have so many social and other problems. Nobody really wanted to grapple with the really tough problems, but I don't have to worry about it. What's the worst that can happen? I'm going to put my all into it. I won't overpromise and underdeliver. And I thought this was something that I had to do, or my last breath, I'd say, you jerk, you should have tried. Maybe you wouldn't have succeeded in either being elected or even being the kind of mayor you thought you'd want to be, but you would have tried. And not trying, to me, was something I really couldn't live with myself about. So it's mental illness. It's really what I said. It's mental illness. Well, my burning question about arches, and I read this, and you'll see these little post-it notes. These are little corrections that I...
All in the Philly section.
All in the Philly section. I couldn't tell. Having been to Vermont, and I love it, I couldn't make any corrections about Brattleboro or, you know, any of those places in Vermont, but I knew about Philly and cop lingo. So I made some notes, and And the wonder for me is people have said to me, write a book, I could never do it because I keep secrets. Like, come in here and they never come out of here. How do you discipline yourself every year? And this is like an ongoing saga. To put this book down and say, okay, this is number 25, I'm finished. Do you ever get to the point where you say, okay, I've run the string out. I'm going to start with another person. Her name is going to be Maggie McBride.
Yeah.
I'm going to start on a new character development, a new plot development. So that's really, when do you finish with Joe and pick up Maggie?
Well, the interesting thing to me is that Maggie and Joe, since I'm writing about the stuff of human nature, wouldn't be any different. She would be a Maggie and he's a Joe, but I can introduce Maggie to Joe in a Joe book. It's funny. I've had a lot of people come to me with exactly this concept that 25 books about the same guy, you know, aren't you bored? You know, and the funny thing is I see the same kind of personality in the mirror that you do every morning. When I wake up, I don't wake up bored. Well, so if I'm writing about us, and therefore kind of about me, then why would I be inclined to write about other people when I'm trying to write about all of us within the construct of this series of books? So if I broaden my mind away from, let's say, the artificiality of an Agatha Christie construction, and instead I broaden my view to talk about everything and anything that occurs to me, be it hoarding or any other number of issues that pop into my mind, and I use this series of books as a sort of fulcrum or a diving board into these subjects, I really don't have any incentive to artificially write about different named people. Now,
even if they weren't police officers, they were something else?
Well, the interesting thing is that sometimes there's one of the books, for example, focuses very largely on a guy who could be called as occupying the twilight area of legality. So Joe Gunther is there and all the other investigators and whatnot, but they play back role. And this guy dominates this story, which is called Tagman, because he has the unseemly habit of visiting your house while you're asleep in bed. And he just likes to look at you. He doesn't do anything indecent. He's a peeper. But he peeps from very up close and personal. Well, he was such an intriguing psychological character that he's the major player in that book and becomes kind of obliquely a good guy because of the things he knows and the things that he can actually help the police with, because he gets the inside scoop where they can't even legally trespass. So if I allow myself that kind of latitude, in a way, I've got the world as my oyster. So I don't want any of my readers to ever come to me a year after I write a book, because it takes me a year to write a book, and say, gosh, been there, done that. You're getting to be a little bit of a retread. So I therefore challenge myself in each one of these books to run the risk of failure by writing with the same characters, yes, but about a completely different topic about which I know very little. So far it seems to be working, and so far I haven't been getting those snoozing emails about, oh, boring, which I never want to get. Oh, this one right here. I haven't screwed it up yet by writing it. It's got bestseller written all over it. Anyone else? I haven't the slightest idea. No clue. I mean, I've knocked off major characters, and I haven't known that was going to happen until I wrote the sentence. That's how unprofessionally I write some of these books. I like the spontaneity. I like the risk of not pre-planning over much. Because I want to write these books kind of as you read them, one page at a time, and I want the spontaneity to be the stimulus to the characters. I hate the idea of emulating Alfred Hitchcock, for example, who so perfectly pre-planned his movies that he candidly admitted in an interview with a biographer of his that when it came time to actually shoot the film, he only did so for the company that was paying him. But in fact, he was bored to tears, and he could have done it with his back turned to the set. I want the exact reverse experience. I would sooner sacrifice the architectural integrity of the plotting, and instead just write from the seat of my pants, and then go backwards in the editing process and fix up some of those more egregious rough edges. It's interesting that Lynn, this paperback that she's flapping around is called an ARC, an advanced reading copy. It's pre-edited at some level. And so one, unfortunately, just one. All the other ones she got me good. But on one of the corrections that she mentioned, I fixed it, but not in this edition. So that's how I may edit these books up to 20 times before I release them to the publisher. So that's how I make it look all smooth and keen and seamless and well thought out. In fact, they all start as disasters, but they're my disasters, and I think they have good guts to them as a result.
Lynn, you told us about the first case, the Tammy Terrell and the barber.
Yep.
What did you get the conviction?
Hey, his name is Haywood Fennell. He's still in prison, and he wrote me asking would I support his parole petition. And I declined to get involved in it because I'm not in the office any longer. But the answer is no. His nickname is Red Dog. They call him Red Dog. And no, I didn't go his parole because he's carrying out the sentence that the jury imposed on him. And that's... I left it up. If they want to parole him, it's okay with me. Random commutation from his life sentence. I'm not going to fight with the parole board or the commutation board, but I'm not going to. I'll tell you why I'm not going to do it. There's a very interesting story. Lieutenant Governor Mark Single, when he became the governor, the acting governor, he came to me and he said, I'm running for governor for my own term. And I'd like you to support me. I liked Mark a lot. He was a bright guy, really good lieutenant governor. And the governor left. It was a long story. I won't get into it now. It's too boring. But the lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania sits by designation on the board of commutation and pardons. So that when a person gets a life sentence or a death sentence, for that matter, or any kind of sentence, you can ask for a commutation of the sentence, which means that you commute the sentence from what it is to something less. In a life situation, when a person is sentenced to life, we don't have 25 years to life. We have either life or a term of years. Mm-hmm. So the person comes up and asks the board to commute his sentence from life to something less. And we had this one guy, his name is Reginald McFadden, who, when he was 16 years of age, this is why truth is so much better than fiction. He found an older woman who would live by herself, who he thought had a lot of money, and he murdered her. He strangled her and robbed her and, you know, abused her corpse, and eventually he was caught. And he was convicted not by me but by somebody else, Ed Rendell, I think, and was given a life sentence. He became what they call a model prisoner. He was the soul of helpfulness to other prisoners. He took younger prisoners under his wing and taught them how to be good. He took college courses. He was the best prisoner on God's green earth. And after 25 years, he amassed a lot of support of people who said, guy suffered enough. He was only 16. He had a 16-year-old brain. He didn't realize what he was doing, yada, yada, yada. And Ed Rendell fought it and fought it and fought it. But the board, including Mark Single, voted 4-1 to overturn his life sentence. The only person to object was the then Attorney General, Ernest Preet, who I had nothing to do with. I wasn't on the board. I had nothing to say. Whatever the board did, the board did. So when it got to the governor's desk, the governor signed it because there was a... So anyway, Mark Single, this had been done before Mark Single was there as the acting governor. He was the lieutenant governor at the time. So by the time he became the acting governor and wanted to run for himself, he came to me and said, will you support me? I said, sure, you're a good guy. You've done a lot of things for Philadelphia. I liked him a lot. We were coming out on the steps. The whole press corps was waiting there. And I said to him, gee whiz, Mark, you've got so many press people here. This is like fabulous. What did you arrange for a brass band? All these guys out there, a whole, just a swath of cameras. So I'm walking down the steps, and the purpose of my being there was to say I'm supporting Mark Single for governor. And some newsie comes out with another microphone and sticks under to Mark's face and says, Acting Governor Single, what do you have to say about Reginald McFadden? And he said, what about Reginald McFadden? He had just been released 3 weeks before. He said, didn't you know he was arrested in New York today? He murdered three people, two old women, and a guy he picked up on a sexual liaison murdered him, took his wallet, and threw him in the East River. And the old ladies, he did the same thing to these two old ladies that he did to our old lady. What do you have to say about that? And I said,
oy, 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 what do you have to say about that?
I didn't say anything. I mean, I wasn't there to defend him. He had to answer. And then he started to tap dance, and it was, you know what, you could see the temperature gauge on his popularity go up here, and then it went straight down. Yeah. And that one thing killed forever his chances to be the governor. He was roundly defeated. And that case hung around him like a noose. And that's why when I listened to the people who wanted me to write in favor of this guy, Haywood Fennell, I wouldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. If somebody else wanted to do it, no problem. I wouldn't object to it. I wouldn't say don't do it. I just couldn't bring myself to do it because I thought about Reginald McFadden. I said, what happens if I say okay? And he gets out and he does it again.
Yeah. Then, Norman Mailer, I mean, and then the belly of the beast.
Well,
all
actually,
again.
Norman Mailer with Jack Abbott. Yeah. Norman Mailer stomped all over for Jack Abbott, who had stabbed a guy to death. And this guy had real talent. He wrote a book called In the Belly of the Beast with Norman Mailer. This guy's going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. He got him out of prison, had his prison term commuted. He got into a fight with some guy, did the same thing to him, stabbed him to death in a doorway. Only a short time after Abbott had been released from prison. So I'm not saying this is everybody, and I do believe in second chances. I absolutely believe in that. But you know what? When your name is on the piece of paper, then it's your fault. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't want that. I didn't want the life of someone else to be based on my signature. I just couldn't do it. So for good or ill, thank you.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.